You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This ruling class is dangerous, but also decadent, because they don't want to recognize the real problems of people, and they don't put any effort to try to solve them. So, for instance, in these societies, homelessness is treated not as something that should be solved, but something that should be managed. If girls are dropping out of school, they treat that as something to be managed. But a real class that leads society to solve problems, not to manage them. And that's the difference between a decadent ruling class and a ruling class with vitality.
That's Vijay Prashad, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Vijay Prashad on the decline of the Global North. The Global North, or the West, is a group of countries led by the United States. In juxtaposition is the Global South, once called the Third World. In recent years, the Global North has undergone significant economic and political decline. The geopolitical landscape is shifting, thus opening new possibilities for Global South countries, particularly for China. A dramatic example of America's isolation was the UN vote on Palestinian membership. The vote was 143 in favor, 25 abstentions, and 9 against. Joining the U.S. no vote were such powerhouses as Nauru, Micronesia, and Palau. Increasingly, the U.S. position in the world is weakening. Its double standards, one set of rules for the master and his servants, and another set for everyone else, has not won Washington many friends in the Global South. Our guest today is Vijay Prashad. He's an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the director of Tricontinental and chief correspondent for Globetrotter. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. He spoke at Connolly Bookstore in Dublin, Ireland in late April 2024. And now, Vijay Prashad.
I want to share with you first a little bit about the nature of this war. You know, I seen the bombing in Iraq. It was ruthless, brutal. The Yanks know how to bomb. The Yanks come in, they bomb the airport. Baghdad airport shut down. They bomb the power plants. They bomb the relay stations. They bomb water purification plants. They bomb the main highways. They shut the society down. In fact, when the Americans went to Ramadi and Fallujah, they just flattened the city. You know, when the Americans fought against ISIS in Mosul, they killed 30,000 civilians. 30,000. Do you remember this? Maybe 2 million people have died in Iraq because of that illegal war. Those numbers are catastrophic. We've forgotten them. I went to Gaza after 2014. There were large parts of Gaza flattened. I thought, my God, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. And you know, it's important for you to know that Gaza isn't a refugee camp. It's not like one big slum. You know, people casually say open-air prison. Yes, it's an open-air prison. But it's an open-air prison with universities, with government buildings, with god-awful, but they exist, malls, with big roads, you know, the main Saladin Highway, and so on. It's a modern society. It's not just refugee camps. It's an error. Some people, I think, visualize Gaza as tents. No, there are apartment buildings and so on, and this becomes important for what I'm going to say to you now about that. You see, what the Israelis did in Gaza is they bombed everything. They bombed the power. They didn't have to bomb the airport. Do you know why they didn't bomb the airport in Gaza this time? Because they bombed the airport in 2002. They destroyed the Yasser Arafat airport in 2002. It's down near Rafah. Wrecked it. They bombed power plants, relay stations, water purification, everything that the Americans did in Iraq. And then they went further. They bombed all the bakeries. They bombed the fishing boats. I mean, it's interesting. They bombed all the ways in which the Palestinians used to eat fresh things. Fish and bread. There's no point bringing flour into Gaza because they destroyed the bakeries. They destroyed electricity supply. People can't cook. You know, you have to cook in barrels, burning wood and so on. This was a concerted attack to destroy the ability of people to live there. This was an earth-shattering attack on the Palestinian ability to live. And then worse than that, they bombed all the neighborhoods. They bombed and destroyed universities. In fact, they didn't just bomb universities from the air. They detonated buildings when they came in. You may have seen the Islamic University main building was possibly detonated. Why? Why destroy the university? They wanted to destroy modern life in Gaza. That's what they were doing. They first hit Gaza City, then they hit Khan Yunis, then they went south of Wadi Gaza, and they started smashing the edge of Rafah, where they are now. Okay, it's brutal. It's unbelievable. I mean, I've seen things in Libya, in Syria, in Iraq. I've never seen anything like this. It is madness what they're doing. It is a different level. And interesting, for the International Court of Justice, it wasn't enough just to talk about the evidence of what's there. You also had to have intent. You know, in terms of the UN Convention on Genocide, it's not just that you're trying to destroy a people by bombing them. You have to demonstrate intent. Well, that was easy. If you looked at the South African complaint, 29-page complaint, it's really still worth reading the South African complaint. There's a long section on the statements by high officials of the Israeli government on what they're doing. They say the most outrageous things. Human savages, they call them. They say the Gaza Nakba, Nakba means catastrophe, referring to 1948, the Nakba of 1948, expulsion of the Palestinians in Gaza Nakba, the second Nakba. We're going to not allow them to have water. We are not going to allow them to have food. By the way, saying that and then bombing bakeries, that itself is a war crime. 10% of the bombs dropped by the Israelis on Gaza are unexploded. That's the assumption of the United Nations. And the UN has now said it'll take 14 years to clear the unexploded ordnance in Gaza. 14 years. During that period, I don't know how many kids playing in here and there are going to be killed. This is exactly what happened in Vietnam. The Yanks dropped so much unexploded ordnance, and for years after, young Vietnamese children playing in the thing, or peasants farming, dead, explosion. Yeah? That's what's going to happen. 37 million tons of rubble. I asked an engineer friend of mine, if you dumped all of that rubble into the Mediterranean, what would it produce? He said, probably produce another Gaza. But you can't dump it into the Mediterranean because it's toxic. And here's the other thing. There's 2.3 million people in Palestine, right? 2.3 million. I'm giving you all these facts. I know you're already in support of the Palestinians. That's not the case I'm making. I just want to establish a ton of facts because I think it's important to know this stuff. You know, it's not enough to say the Israelis are being genocidal. They're actually being genocidal. Like in general, we use these terms sometimes hyperbolic way, you know, genocidal. This is actually genocide. Andrew Gilmore, former deputy head of human rights at the United Nations. Andrew Gilmore, BBC Talk Night, normally filled with lies, that program, I agree. But in this case, Andrew Gilmore says the kill rate in Gaza is only matched by the kill rate in Rwanda 1994. Look, if you go to a war zone, 2.3 million people, huge number of children, There's two aspects of a war that nobody talks about. Outside we hear 35,000 plus dead, right? 7,000 to 8,000 missing. Out of those, probably 85% children. Those facts are there. But what we don't hear about war zones are two things. One is the noise. It's unbelievably loud. And that scars a generation of children. You know, if any of you have raised children or are raising children, you will know that you spend an unbelievable amount of time in your homes trying to maintain a certain silence so that the children go to sleep in peace. You read them a story, you give them a bath, you calm them down, you stroke their head, and then you send them peacefully into sleep. Hope they have a dream where you are the nice person. That's the way most children in the world should go to sleep. But for months on end, there is loud noise at night. I experienced this first in Iraq because everybody bombs at night. They don't bomb during the day. It's a stupid thing because it's from the time when you could evade ground-to-air fire, right? ACAC fire. So you come in at night and bomb. I mean, when we're talking about Iraq or when you're talking about Palestine, there really isn't any ground-to-air fire. I mean, the Palestinians are not sitting there with a Bofors, you know, howitzer gun able to hit an Israeli plane. You know, at most they're firing an AK-47 or a Kalashnikov into the air. It's futile. It's impossible to hit a plane like that. So I don't know why they bomb at night. It's a habit or whatever, but they still come at night. Loud noise at night. Children are just scarred for an entire generation. But it's not just the noise. It's the toxins. Again, you see on Instagram or whatever, you see images, yeah, of an Israeli plane going and a building collapsing, right? And you say, wow, how many people died in there? Forget the people who died in there. Modern buildings are made of all the worst industrial glues. There are all kinds of toxins in everything in construction. When you blow up a building, all that stuff goes into the air. So 2.3 million people are breathing in these heavy metals, toxins of all kinds. They're going to suffer for a long time. I know that in Ramadi General Hospital, because of the use of depleted uranium, generation of kids was born with all kinds of deformities after the United States used depleted uranium. But even in places like Mosul and Basra and places, you saw birth defects. They may not have used depleted uranium, but they were bombing modern buildings. So people are breathing in these toxins. That stuff impacts a generation, okay? So this war, if it stops tomorrow, the death is going to continue from this for a very long time. Unexploded ordnance, people with lung diseases, different kind of ailments and so on, and children traumatized, for entire generation of children traumatized. I mean, in Jerusalem, I visited a school about 6-7 years ago. In fact, the person who took me to that school is now herself arrested, Nadira Shalob Kavorkian. She's a professor at Hebrew University. Children draw all kinds of things. One of the things they were drawing were clowns. All the children's clowns were crying. And they asked, why are your clowns crying? And they said, Palestinian clowns cry. I thought that was a very powerful line. Palestinian clowns cry. These children have been traumatized, generation upon generation. Now maybe 4 generations, 5 generations of Palestinians. That's the war that's happening. You know, that's what it really is all about. It's not just the number of dead. It's the character of the war. It's so different from other wars. Even the battle going on in the Democratic Republic of Congo, near Goma and so on, it's not like this. I mean, yes, M23 rebels are coming in from maybe Rwanda or crossing the Ugandan border, but they don't have air support, not like this. They're not coming in and just blasting entire neighborhoods. It's terrifying. They're not drones flying all over, just firing at people as they walk down the street. This is terrible. And it's just happening. And the thing everybody sees is that almost all the governments of the global north are fully backing this. I mean, the German government has been the most disgusting of them all. Frankly, Germany should introspect about its own history. Anti-Semitism is not an Arab problem. It's not an Asian problem. It's a European problem. Europeans need to deal with their own problems. They can't outsource it and blame other people who are standing up for their own rights for being anti-Semitic. It's insane. There was a time when people used to accuse me of anti-Semitism. I used to feel scared. Now I just feel it's ridiculous. You know, just stop it. You know, there's nothing anti-Semitic about anything I'm saying. It's stupid. Stop doing this. But these governments can't help it. They just can't help it. They continue to back Israel fully. And Israel knows that these governments aren't going to shift at all. You know, but that is what's really interesting. The fact that these governments can't move means that, A, the populations in these societies have become very restive, very angry. What's happening in the United States now is interesting. These tens of thousands of students who are just refusing to be scared, building tent cities, confronting the police, and what do the administrators do? And by the way, it's not just the students, it's their teachers as well who are coming out there. What do the administrators do? The administrators behave like their governments. They send in the police departments. They make mass arrests. I mean, the credibility of whether it's Olaf Scholz or Joe Biden or these presidents of different US colleges, their credibility is getting shredded. They don't have any credibility. I mean, how can Olaf Scholz be credible? And what's interesting about that credibility question is the credibility was first questioned in the South. I found that very interesting. And do you remember when South Africa first took Palestine to the International Criminal Court? Does anybody remember when that was? It was in 2002, 22 years ago. South Africa took Palestine to the criminal court based on a complaint that the wall they were building around the West Bank was a wall that was going to facilitate apartheid. So a very interesting case they brought, and they won that case, which is why it's technically correct to call that wall around the West Bank an apartheid wall. Israel is a party to the Oslo Accords, signed in 1994, establishes the Palestinian Authority. The Oslo Accords establishes the reality of a state of Palestine, which was to be the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. If you read the Oslo Accords, it very clearly says that the Palestinians need to have safe passage between these three areas. So if you are a Palestinian in Gaza, you have to be able to go freely to East Jerusalem or the West Bank. Almost the day after they signed the Oslo Accords, the Israelis violated them. They didn't allow Palestinians to move out of these three enclaves. They simply started garroting them, hemming them in, and then seizing the land, particularly in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, but also in Gaza. You remember the settlement building that took place before the election in 2005 and then the subsequent Israeli withdrawal. South Africans had the guts to do this in 2002, when the world situation was different. If you remember 2002, the Yanks were getting ready to go to war against Iraq. Million people in the United States marched on the street. Millions more in Europe and in the Arab world and so on said no war on Iraq. The United Nations Security Council refused to give a resolution for that war. But the United States went ahead in 2003 with the shock and awe campaign. March 2003 smashed Iraq, right? It's in that period that the South Africans, God knows where they got the confidence, went to the ICJ to say this wall is not correct. And that actually comes from their history of the anti-apartheid struggle. That's the real resilience of the South Africa 2002. But this is different. Between 2002 and 2023-24, there have been about 10 direct bombings of Gaza. Enormously monumental bombings. 2014, in just a few weeks, the Israelis killed 3,000 Palestinians. Bam! I thought there can't be a worse war than that. Nobody said a word. There's been silence right through this. You know, massacre in Jenin, the young children arrested. I was in the West Bank outside Ramallah in a refugee camp. I gave a talk to a whole bunch of young Palestinians they wanted to know about the strategy of the Indian Revolution. Serious, these young kids invited me to what was called the Edward Said Hall to talk about the strategy of the Indian Revolution. I was like, this is bizarre. So I was talking to them about what is the strategy, the People's Democratic State has to blah, 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 all this stuff. At the end, these young kids, 16, 17 years old from the camps, come in and they said, we don't have the time for all this strategy. Right. We need to fight them. It's a military struggle. I was like, guys, take it easy. We need a strategy, otherwise you'll just all get killed by the Israelis. This is the time when young kids would rush against the police or a military officer and get shot. Or sometimes they didn't even rush, they were just getting shot at checkpoints. I was like, don't do that, guys. That was the mood right through. Desolation, desperation, hopelessness, complete, utter hopelessness. Nobody anywhere in the world was standing with them to say, hey, Israel, you can't bomb like this. You know, I mean, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2012, 2014, punctual bombing of Gaza. There was no complaint from any country. But this time, South Africa goes to the ICJ with a criminal complaint, very strong complaint. When South Africa went to the ICJ, Germany came in and said that there is no genocide. Do you remember this? Germany came in. Germany, God, why are you poking your nose into this? The response to Germany doesn't come from anybody other than Namibia. And that struck me as fascinating. You know, Namibia used to be Southwest Africa. It was a German colony. It's governed by the Southwest African People's Organization, which was a National Liberation Front. But like many National Liberation Fronts, over the period of the Third World Debt Crisis, the fall of the Soviet Union, they basically became a neoliberal party. You know, the options for movement were limited. So SWAPO effectively became the party of privatization, attracting foreign direct investment, you know, all the buzzwords, austerity and so on. I thought, you know, that SWAPO man, that's their politics now. It's a bunch of guys in suits. They exchanged their military fatigues for suits. They don't have the will to resist anything. They are basically managing this society now. I remember going to Indo, talking to people there. I was like, this is, where is the essence of your fight? You know, where is the fight that your guerrillas took in Quito Conivale alongside the Angolans, MPLA, and the Cubans against the South African forces? The great defeat of South Africa in 1987, that was a big blow against apartheid. When the Angolans, the Namibians, the Cubans, the South Africans defeated the South African racist military at Quito Conivale. What a great battle. Where did that go? You know, that was the feeling. Like, what the hell? Germany comes in and says, it is not genocide. Can't do a very good German accent, but otherwise I would. It is not genocide. Just imagine, like a sort of Hegelian thing, that certainties of the German, you know, language. There's no ambiguity. It is not genocide. And then the Namibian president sends a statement out, which was remarkable. It was direct. Where did it come from? He says directly to the German people, you don't have the right to talk about what is or isn't genocide. It's because you've done a genocide. And, you know, most people who wouldn't know the history think that he's referring to the Holocaust. But he wasn't. He said, when you ruled Southwest Africa, 1904 to 1908, you conducted a genocide. You wiped out the Herero people and you wiped out the Nama people. You extinguished these people from the face of the earth. And you've never acknowledged it and you've never apologized for it. I mean, this is a niche area. Only a few surviving people of the Herero and Nama communities know about this, and historians. Nobody else, this is not widely known stuff, yeah? It's like a niche atrocity. And it happened in Southwest Africa. Come on, guys, how many of you knew about this? You know, one of you I know was nodding, but maybe two of you or whatever. It's a niche atrocity, right? There are mainstream atrocities, such as the Holocaust, and then there's niche atrocities happen to be mostly on the African continent. So nobody cares. The benefits of racism is you can forget all the atrocities on the African continent. It's a great benefit of racism. And he said this to the Germans. This angered the Germans a lot. Because after all, somehow they've been able to reconstruct themselves as the great people of democracy and human rights. It's incredible. You listen to German chancellors, Merkel, Schroeder. I mean, who made these guys like an authority on human rights? Like, guys, some of you were Nazis. And if not you, your parents or your grandparents were Nazis. Like, how can you lecture us on anything? You guys were the Nazis. We were not the Nazis. My family, my grandfather, fought in Italy as a bloody conscripted soldier against Italian fascists. We are not bloody fascists, man. Our people, my uncles, died off the coast of Spain, being dragooned to go and fight in France. You think they even knew where the hell France was? They came from Punjab. A torpedo hit their ship off the coast of Spain. Before they fired a gun, they were dead. They came to fight the bloody Nazis, man. We are not Nazis. You're a Nazi. How can you talk about human rights? What about us talking about human rights? It's completely bizarre. You know, when I listen to like these guys, like now Olaf Scholz, on the other hand, if I had a picture of six people, you wouldn't be able to pick him out. I really doubt that any of you know what Olaf Scholz looks like. Can anybody put their hands up with confidence? Really? I bet you if I bring five photographs in a lineup, a criminal lineup, you may not pick the exact Olaf Scholz. The Ersatz one, maybe. Who knows what these people look like? It's hard to not get Rishi Sunak. He's just, he has something criminal on his face. Impossible to miss that stupid, idiotic smile that he does, right? It's really bizarre, that smile. Like, Rishi, what's so funny, man? It's a funny face he's got. So, that was Namibia. You know, and then one country after the other. Nicaragua takes Germany to the ICJ. Bolivia supports the case. Venezuela makes strong statements. Colombia supports the case fully, and so on. Not one global North country supported the case. Not one. It's very interesting just if you look at that itself. The peoples of these countries came out on the street. You can't go 5 meters in Ireland without bumping into a Palestinian flag. And then look at your prime minister. He said that fantastic line. I don't know where it came from. It came from all these flags, Palestinian flags in Ireland. The sentence he said in the US, that spelled his doom. I mean, I don't know why he resigned. I never really figured that out. But that was quite a statement. I listened to that and thought, wow, that's interesting. Another mediocre neoliberal politician says something heavy, but then few days later, he's gone. Yeah? We are in a very interesting situation in the world. In a sense, already, there's been a great depletion of the power of the global north. But because of this war and then Ukraine, and the way in which the global north has operated in terms of both of them, there's been a subjective decline in legitimacy of these ruling classes in the north.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad, The Decline of the Global North. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
India, governed by a far-right government, has had a very interesting reaction to both of these conflicts. And I think slightly misunderstood reaction.